T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.
Baseball is back, basketball is heating up, and the NFL draft is right around the corner. Listen to the latest on the teams you love here on the Odyssey app. The biggest sports radio stations in the country, providing unrivaled local coverage of their teams, all in one place. Exclusive interviews with players, coaches, and team executives, streaming live and always available on demand. Stay in the know with your favorite teams right here on the Odyssey app.
Welcome to Beyond Black History Month. This is a hip-hop made takeover. I'm your host, Femi Redwood.
Hip-hop made.
Even if you don't love hip-hop, you probably know a few bars from the song Rapper's Delight by Sugar Hill Gang. It was the first hip-hop song to be put on a record and the first hip-hop song to hit the Billboard charts. The group formed in 1979. Its members, Henry Jackson, also known as Big Bank Hank, Michael Wright, aka Wonder Mike, and Guy O'Brien, aka Master G. Its success surprised a lot of people. I mean, whereas hip-hop was born out of the Bronx and MCs cut their teeth at neighborhood parties or clubs like Harlem World, these teenagers were mostly from the suburbs of New Jersey. But while the group had its share of controversies and criticism, the single was a hit and helped open the door for other hip-hop artists. Okay, so last week we continued our story about the birth of hip-hop. I spoke with Master G for over an hour. He had a lot to say, and it just wouldn't fit in that episode. So this week I'm bringing you our full conversation. We talk about it all, how his upbringing prepared him for the group, the critiques that the band faced for years, how he feels about hip hop today, and what's next for him. Please introduce yourself, even though
Yes. You
don't need introduction.
Bless your heart. Well, I'll do it this way. Well, I'm the M-A-S, the T-E-R, the G with a double E, and I go by the unforgettable name of the man they call the Master G. Hey, Femi.
Nice. I love that these many years later, you still have it.
That's the best compliment anybody can pay me. A lot of times when we do concerts, that's what, you know, I get. People are like, man, I close my eyes and you sound just like, you still sound like the record. And that's a cool thing. So, I'm glad I could still be able to make that happen.
I love that. All right. So for people who don't know, I guess there are people that live under a rock, you know, no shade. Tell us your story before you even got to Sugar Hill Gang. Apparently you were flying airplanes and doing all of these things before.
Yes. So I come from a pretty interesting household. I was born in New York, a medical center in New York, and I grew up in the Teaneck, Hackensack, Englewood area. Really grew up on Teterboro Airport. My dad was a corporate pilot, so we had a plane. He was a trumpet player. We had a studio in the basement. We're talking like 1970, 68, 70. We had a studio. We were recording jazz legends, you know. So I grew up in a music setting, and I grew up in an entrepreneur-like setting, as we talked about. Mm-hmm. You know, they were very aspiring, self-made people in my life. And so I tell people that all roads lead to me being who I am today. And I was given an opportunity to really express myself. I started playing drums when I was 7. You know, a lot of cool. I was DJing. I started DJing when I was like 15. That's really kind of got me into rapping. And I started as a DJ. Then I heard somebody, there was an upperclassman. His name is Mark Green. He'll hear us where he's at. And he's still a friend. I heard him at a party rapping. I asked him what he was doing. He said, I'm rapping, man. That's what they're doing over in New York, you know. And so I put that into my repertoire of DJing and rapping. And I was doing parties in Hackensack, and I started doing parties in Englewood. And then one thing led to another. And I walked in front of the pizza parlor in the summer of 79. in August and met Sylvia Robinson, bless her heart and rest her soul. And she thought that I was cute and I sounded good. And the rest is history. We went in the studio and cut that record.
Give me the whole story from Sylvia and her son to how it is that you all then got in front of the mic.
Okay. So Sylvia had a niece. And Sylvia, for those who don't know, is Sylvia Robinson. She came from Mickey and Sylvia, Love is Strange, and then she had her own career, Pillow Talk, and she wrote and recorded The Moments, Love on a Two-Way Street, and various other hits. She also had a recording facility in our town in Englewood, New Jersey. So her niece took her to a party, Harlem World. This was Harlem World back in the day. She heard, God rest his soul, Love Bug Starsky rapping. And so she asked if that was on record. And at the time, it wasn't on record. It was only going on in the streets. So her son was around our age. So he was in the Jersey area. Taken back to Jersey, they start looking for people who can rap because she says, this needs to be on record. They decide to, you know, re-record Good Times because it was the breakbeat of the summer. So they had the music already. They were going to use one guy from a group called Sound on Sound. The guy turned him down. In the process of that, was a guy in the pizza parlor who was from the Bronx who we knew. He made pizzas, a black dude, and he rapped, and everybody knew about him. So they were looking to hear him. And in that process, I was walking down the street. My friend, who was another guy named Mark Green, believe it or not, two Mark Greens. Spoke to Joey, which was Sylvia's son, and that's what happened. They were like, we're looking for people who can rap. And my friend was like, well, if you want to hear somebody rap, you need to listen to him. So I got in the back of the car when I started rapping. And so initially we thought it was only going to be one person. So I thought I was in competition with Hank, and I was already intimidated because he was the guy from the Bronx,
right,
you know, who was legitimately supposed to be the real deal. Then we went up to her house. Mike came up. Because he knew the DJ that suggested Good Times. Mm-hmm. And in the evening, when it was about to end, he said, well, you, Miss Robinson, I know you heard me on the tape. I had a cold that day. Could you listen to me? And he proceeded to just rip and tear and do his thing. And so that's what happened. She said, rather than choose between the three of you, three is my favorite number. I'm going to put the three of you together. And then we went to the studio and cut Rappers Delight, and here we are.
Back then, like you said, there were no records.
No.
The way people were able to hear this music was either these tapes that were passed around or being at a party. She approached you and said, we're going to make a record, something that hadn't been done, what did you initially think?
Because of my background, it didn't seem wild to me. Mm. So it was like, okay, we're going to do a record. And I was like, okay, that sound cool. Now, did I think it was going to be something meteoric? No, I just thought it was going to be cool because, again, I had been around that city. As a matter of fact, my father had done sessions at the same studio, in the same studio I cut Rappers Delight in. Yeah. So I knew the studio because when she started explaining to me where the studio was, I was like, wait a minute. This is the L-shaped building off of Palisade Avenue? She said, yes. And I used to run through that hall. It was my father's OB and da-da-da. So she knew my dad and she remembered me as a little kid. So it wasn't odd for me to be in the studio and cut anything. So when I cut Rappers Delight, I really thought it was just, you know, an opportunity to be a little bit more popular in Englewood, Teaneck, and Hackensack. I'd get some dates. I'd do some
Not
parties.
Some dates.
Oh, yeah. You know, I'm 17 years old. You know, I was an awkward kid. I mean, even though I had all these cool things going on, I was a little bit, you know, out of the loop.
Love that things have not changed.
No.
Whether or not it's my 17-year-old nephew today.
Exactly.
Back in the day.
No, hey.
Okay.
You know, we motivated by the women. I mean, come on. It's the truth.
Yeah.
I'm still motivated today by women. Come on.
Now, see, that's a whole nother podcast.
Yeah,
see,
that's different. That's something
that's
else. Yeah. Right. But, yes, so... You know, that was the deal. I mean, we were kids and, you know, we were working to get it done. And that was that. I didn't think it was going to go any further than the New York metropolitan area. I really did. I thought it was going to be New York, Connecticut, New Jersey. It was going to be cool. It was going to go. I was going to go to 12th grade because I was in junior high school.
Mm-hmm.
Excuse me. I was in the junior year of my high school. I was going to go to senior year. I was going to graduate and go into the military because I was getting out of here.
Oh, wow.
That was my game plan because I wasn't going to go to college. I really didn't have that, you know, mindset, but I needed to do something.
Right.
And because I had been around planes and we did some traveling, I was really already with that. I was like, okay, well, I'll enlist.
Mm-hmm.
And I like the Marines uniform. No, it was about some clothes.
About the aesthetics, always, I love it. Okay.
So I liked the uniform, and I was like, okay. And I thought I was a little tough too when I was a kid. So, like, I'm going to Marines. I'm going to travel. That was it. But, you know, of course, it ended up very different.
Very different. You know what's interesting? So I've interviewed a ton of people for the series already. And
yes.
Everyone says, I ask the same question, what was the first song or album that made you fall in love with hip hop? And it is always...
Rapper's Delight.
Always, without a doubt.
It's amazing.
When did you realize that, oh, wait, this is more than just cutting a record and then going into the military? What was that moment, if you remember?
The record had come out. We started doing shows, and we performed at Rutgers University. So we did, the first two shows we did was at a place called the Paradiso in Newark. It was a club back in the day, Broad Street. And we did a matinee, and we did a nighttime show, and then we did a matinee. The matinee, we didn't even get through it because the girls were going too crazy. And
really?
Like, literally, we had to run off the stage and... You know, that was, and then we did this concert at Rutgers University with Black Ivory. I don't know if you remember Black Ivory, but they were an R&B group. And literally, like, while I was performing, they were trying to, like, literally pull me off the stage, like, grab the laces of my shoes and the bodyguards. That's kind of, at that moment, I was like, wait a minute, this is kind of like what I had seen, like the Jackson 5, because, you know, I grew up in that era. So, you know, the Jackson 5, there was a group called the Silvers. There was, you know, Earth, Wind & Fire, Commodores. Those were all the groups that I grew up looking at and listening to. So I knew about how, you know, R&B groups were perceived and, you know, Soul Train, everybody saw, you know, and, that night, I said, wait a minute, I'm getting the same kind of response and the reactions that I saw these other groups. And it was like, yeah, this might be something here. And it was.
What do you think it was? Like, what was that something? Like, was it because this was the first one on an album? Or do you think it was something bigger than that, more special than that? And that's not to trash anyone else who was creating music at the time. But what do you think it was that made it more special at that moment?
It was the perfect combination. I mean, the music was phenomenal. It was the breakbeat of the summer. That was first of all. The voice qualities. Hank's amazing voice. Mike's incredible voice. You know, I got a pretty good voice myself. The content. You know, Mike's talking about what you hear is not a test, and we're rapping to the beat. You know, Hank, Superman and that whole thing. And I'm pleading my case to the female population of the world. I had to make sure I put that in there. and you had the cosmetic aspect of it. You know, I was a teenager, so, you know, you had that. Mike was a little bit older. We were in our 20s. It was just everything was the right, and the timing was perfect for it because it was already a movement going on in the street. So we had just, what was going on in the street, we just took it and put it on a form where everybody had access to it. You didn't have to go to the Bronx, or you didn't have to be at the, you know, rooftop or whatever the case may be. You could now turn your radio on and get it. So that helped.
Outside of performances, so I think, like, often with hip hop culture, right, there is the music that people who are into hip hop truly, like the true fans, right, they enjoy. And then there are the other people, like, kind of fans, da da da. But did you ever hear your music played at one of the neighborhood parties, at a jam with, like, true hip hop fans? And if so, what did that feel like? How did the crowd react, and what did it feel like?
So the thing you have to understand about us is that we went from being DJs and rappers to literally R&B stars. So from me doing basement parties for $50 and dance halls for $100, I was now on tour with the Funkadelic. I was doing shows all over the United States. We had, you know, now we were doing Soul Train. I was kind of removed from the scene. So if my music was being played somewhere, I'm sure that it was.
Right.
But
right,
I was, right. You know, we were like literally went from, you know, a kid in the neighborhood to, you know, the hottest thing in the country.
Oh, was that shift difficult?
Totally. Yeah,
how
I wasn't.
So?
I was not prepared for that magnitude of attention. It's very unnatural to have that kind of attention paid to. Even to this day, it's still very very difficult for me to deal with, you know, because it's almost like you're walking on water, you know, and you can do no wrong in people's eyes when it's not really the case, you know. And so you start getting a warped sense of reality. And I had to really kind of navigate being, because again, I'm 17, so I'm still formed as a person, as a man. So I had to deal with that. Then at the same time, I was thrusted into this, white hot fame, and at the same time also try to figure out how to get through life. So it was very, very strange. Those first between 17 to 23, that first block was very strange for me.
I did not realize you toured with, you said, Parliament.
Yeah, the first major tour we went on. Yeah,
how was that?
That was wild. I was 18 at that point. Yeah. Yeah. And I
explain people who may not know.
Right. Yeah. Funkadelic. Yeah. So George Clinton, Knee Deep, all of that situation, Flashlight, for those of you that don't know. And they were the older guys. They were seasoned individuals. So you name it, drug, sex, and rock and roll was going on. And, here's this kid that, is coming from the suburbs to, George Clinton and the crew. And it was wild. It was eye-opening, to say the least.
I am sure. Yes. It was a 15-minute long song.
Yes.
That was very long.
Yes.
Why was it 15 minutes long?
Okay. So even though I was in a studio setting, I was very familiar. I had never been on the mic recording anything. Now, I'd been on the mic many times at a party. So if you come to do the party, let's say the party starts at 8 and it goes to 1. Okay, so you're going to be rapping quite a few times and for quite some time. Same thing with Hank, same thing with Mike. So when they initially laid the music down, you get a set of musicians, they go in, they say, okay, we're going to lay down a track. So they lay it down, and they lay it down until the people say stop. So they laid down that body of work. Well, when we came into the studio to record, we had already decided, because Mike said, what you hear is not a test, he's going to go first, and then it's called a mic pass. So if I say 1, 2, 3, 4, come on, Fame, get on the floor, that means that I'm going to stop rapping and you're going to start rapping. That's called a pass. Okay, so we decided that Mike would go first, Hank would go second, I would go third. Okay, so the music starts, Mike does his thing, he passes to Hank, Hank passes to me, the music's still playing, so I passed it back to Mike. Mike passed it to Hank, Hank passed it back to me, the music's still playing, I passed it back to Mike. Mike passed it to Hank, Hank passed it to me, and we went. And the only reason why we stopped is because the music stopped. But if the music was 30 minutes, we would have kept going. Because nobody in the control room, that was the other thing, the experts or the people that knew what was going on, they didn't tell us to stop. So because nobody told us to stop, we just assumed that this was the way it was supposed to be. Now, of course, afterwards we realized that, songs aren't 15 minutes long. So now we started getting the knowledge of writing songs and, hook, verse, and that kind of thing. But that initial recording was three guys that had never done it before in a room full of people who were supposed to know what's happening, that I guess they just let it happen. I guess because it was sounded so good, they let it go.
Oh, wow. Yeah, it was when I was younger, my mom would play it. I always wondered, why is this song going for so long? I enjoyed it.
Right.
But I always wondered, why is this song going so long? Do you know what's interesting about this song? It does not matter your age or generation. Again, from my 17-year-old niece or nephew to my dad, who is 67 or 77. Oh, no, he's 77. Everybody knows the song.
It's an amazing, perfect storm. Yeah. This is the best thing that could ever happen to an artist. This record will keep us in beautiful clothes and wonderful lifestyle for quite some time, and it's just one of those things. There are certain songs that are just, that song.
Right.
I mean, like an Earth, Wind, and Fire
song.
Right? You see what I mean? Right?
Yeah.
Shining Star. It doesn't matter.
Does not matter, no.
Ain't No Stopping Us Now. It doesn't matter.
Right.
Billie Jean. It doesn't matter. Rapper's Delight. It doesn't matter. It's the perfect storm. When all the articles and all the elements add up, it never, and it's captured. See, this is the thing about a recording. like we're recording now. This content is being captured. That's what happens. That's what happened with Rappers Delight. You caught that 15, we caught that 15 minutes on that recording. And it's there. So that's genuine. Nothing in that is phony. Nothing in that, it's all there. And so that continues to translate every time you play it. And then the other thing is the connection that people have to the music. If you're not a person that grew up with it, you're a person that saw it or heard it in a commercial, or you saw it or heard it in a TV show, or somebody told you about it, or you went to one of our concerts, or you saw a document. There's just so many different avenues that go, that run to Rapper's Delight. And that's why it's still a major, major. And like you said, I mean, I tour regularly. I mean, I'm on the road more than I'm at home.
Right.
You know, and there's never been a time that you know, we hit the song and it didn't work. I mean, the show could be the worst show in the world.
Right.
There's two records that I know I'm going to get them, Apache and Rapper's Delight. I already know. It doesn't matter. And right. I'm not saying our shows aren't bad. Our shows are generally great. But I'm a really, you know, I'm a hard person on myself. So right. I might say, like, we did the show in a city, I'm not going to say the city, but I didn't really think we were really getting them. Mm. You know, I was like, you know, because it's really important for me, because that's the best time of the day. Mm. I said, it's okay though. I got the bangers coming up. And then sure enough, boom, boom. And then, you know, oh my God. So yeah.
We have to talk about some of the controversies.
Yes,
though.
Of course. It's cool.
First off.
Yes.
Y'all were the first, or rather Rappers Delight was the first song to deal with a sample lawsuit.
Okay. So it wasn't a sample lawsuit.
Oh, it wasn't a sample.
No,
what was it?
There was no such thing as sampling in 1979.
Well, that's what I was going to say. Right. I didn't think. So what was it? And then I guess that's it. Did it not cross anyone's mind because that didn't exist yet?
So it was re-recorded. Mm. So all of that is original recording of the original song, okay? The problem is they didn't do the proper work as far as the rights were concerned with Nile Rodgers and Bernard Edwards. That's what the problem was. That wasn't on our end because, again, we were young and didn't have any idea what was going on that end. That was between what happened with the Robinsons, Nile Rodgers, Bernard Edwards, and that situation. Unfortunately, you know, it didn't turn out like it should have, but over time, it's been worked out. It's a lot better than it was.
Okay.
Yes.
Do you all have, what does that look like today? Do you have to pay them a certain amount of money?
No. So there are revenue streams that are going in different directions. But again, fortunately, once we were able to try to work some things out, a lot of those revenue streams have kind of reverted to us as well. But yes, though the parties that, you know, should get what they get, they get what they get. But initially, it was a little bit hairy.
Right, I'm sure.
They were trying to get it all at first.
Oof.
Yeah.
That would have been rough.
Yeah.
So then since that, I understand that at that time, mm-hmm. you know, we're talking about 79.
Yes.
A lot of these conversations weren't happening yet, specifically sampling. We talk about sampling all the time.
Right.
You name a hip-hop song, it's been sampled.
Right.
Or it's a sample from something. But after that, were there any other protocols in the industry, any changes in the industry where this was now a bigger concern? Because even some of the records that DJs were spinning, DJs weren't spinning hip hop records.
No.
They were spinning Aerosmith, whatever they got their hands
exactly.
on. So since when that initially came out, did that affect any long-lasting changes afterwards in terms of making this stuff a bit more clear?
Well, from that point then, because the sampling really still did not happen till several years after.
Got it.
Initially, we were still re-recording breaks. So whatever break, like Apache is a break. It's from a song called Bongo Rock. Okay.
Right.
Exactly. So what happens is we went into the studio. They said, okay, well, what else do you guys have? The first thing that we did was a song called Eighth Wonder. And that was a break from a song called Seventh Wonder. It was Daisy Lady. That was that part, that bop, 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 bop. So took it in, said, this is the break that we use. Musicians got with it, arranged it. Now, again, we're now in songwriting. So, okay, we need a verse so that you can rap on, and we need the hook. So it became that kind of situation. So all the roads started working out, you know, call the people, make the necessary agreements, et cetera, moving on. So, yeah. And then sampling came. So for a long time, the sample situation went without being properly done. Mm. You know, as a, we talked, you know, people know about the James Brown situation. You know, a lot of his stuff was sampled, and Maze, a lot of the things, Frankie Beverly's stuff was sampled. But eventually, what started happening is the law caught up with the process, and then same thing. You know, everybody gets in the party. This is what's happening.
Right.
This is what goes down, publishing, et cetera. And then from that point on, now you see, you know, every record that is that's sampled, you see that those writers share in that composition moving forward.
Another controversy. It came out later that some of the lyrics were written by Grandmaster Caz.
Yes.
Tell me, did you all know about that? Tell me, give me some insight there.
So again, you have to understand, I'm 17 years old. My life was in, I tell people, I was a suburb kid. You know what I mean? My grandparents, my dad's folks lived in Mount Vernon. They had a three-family house. My grandmother lived in Bed-Stuy. She had one of those beautiful basement apartments on, you know, a very nice street in Brooklyn, Bed-Stuy. So, yeah, I went back and forth across the George Washington Bridge, but I wasn't hanging out at clubs. I didn't go to the parties. I didn't. So so we didn't know. And Mike, basically, thing, same thing. He came from, you know, D.C. He grew up in Newark, went to D.C. He was a suburb kid. You know, we were in Jersey. We didn't know what was going on in the Bronx. The only thing that we knew about, the only person that was tangible to us was Hank. And so he came over with the story is, his story was, I'm rapping, I'm a rapper, and I rap in, you know, the Bronx. So we took it as law. So at the audition, and I tell this story a lot, at the audition, when we were in the car, he's saying, I'm the CAS and the OVA, and the rest is FLY. And I thought that was kind of cool. I was like, wow. So I thought, because again, I, you know, County Monte Cristo, Casanova, you know, I'm watching these movies and series. I'm thinking he's saying he's a Casanova and he's fly. I didn't know that was a person's name. So then we get to the studio because he said the same raps everywhere, all the way up to including that session. And that's the thing that kind of tripped me out. Because like when we went to Miss Robinson's house to audition that night, every time I'd come up with a new rap, he'd keep going back to the same rap. So I'm like, why does he keep saying the same raps?
Right.
Because every person that I knew that rapped, you wrote your rhymes or you freestyled.
Right.
Go in the studio, same thing. He cuts it. He says the same rap. We thinking, okay, the credentials for a rapper is if you rap, you wrote the words. We didn't know Kaz. We didn't even know the Cold Crush existed because Mike and I were in Englewood, Hackensack, and Teaneck. Now the record blows up. Now we start moving around. We start getting around. We start rubbing shoulders with people. And all of a sudden, we find out he did not create those lyrics. Now, here's what the story is. The story is that I'm sure after he did his audition and knew he was going to get this opportunity to record, he probably went to Kaz and said, hey, Kaz, this is what's going on. I need some raps. Now, the story that I hear is that allegedly Kaz said, okay, take the book. Well, you have to always understand, and everybody, because I had a conversation earlier today. See, most people don't remember a time when there was not rap music. Okay. There was no such thing as you could become successful, you could become wealthy, you could live off of your music for the rest. Nobody had any inclinations whatsoever. Now, going into a situation today, first thing a person's going to say is, wait a minute, hold up now. You know, I got to get, you know, my rights and my writing liberty. But you didn't know that in 1979, in the summer of 79, when Hank went to Kaz and said, hey, man, they want me to do something. He's like, okay, whatever. Heck, I think Hank was like a manager for them, or he went out with them. So he was like, okay, sure, whatever.
Right.
What's going to happen? So that's the thing, too. Yes, he didn't go about it the right way, but in the same breath, nobody knew it was going to be what it's become.
Right.
So, you know, that's the thing. You know, and then the other thing that I want to get across to everybody is that Mike wrote every lyric that he ever said. I wrote every lyric that I've ever said. And so sometimes people, they want to group us in. They say, well, all of it, it's fake. They're not real rappers. I was rapping in Englewood. I was rapping in Hackensack. I was writing raps. Mike, the same thing. You know, so sometimes that's the loop that bothers me. People think, oh, well, they were Milli Vanilli. No, we're the real deal.
You did not put Milli Vanilli under the bus.
Did I say that?
You just went drive back in reverse, poor Milli Vanilli.
Bless their heart.
Hey, we have to take a quick commercial break, and then we'll be right back.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.
Baseball is back, basketball is heating up, and the NFL Draft is right around the corner. Listen to the latest on the teams you love here on the Odyssey app, the biggest sports radio stations in the country, providing unrivaled local coverage of their teams, all in one place. Exclusive interviews with players, coaches, and team executives, streaming live and always available on demand. Stay in the know with your favorite teams right here on the Odyssey app.
See? Super quick. Here's the rest of our conversation. But does it, I can already tell it kind of frustrates you. Do you think it tarnishes your legacy, though?
No.
Okay.
No, because good, better, and different, and everything's got, you know, light and dark. Everything. I don't care what you do. I don't care who you are. Kennedy was the greatest president that we've ever had, light and dark. You know what I mean? Right. Does it tarnish his legacy because he's got a little darkness? No. Martin Luther King, light and dark. Does it tarnish his legacy? No. Because he did what he did. We did what we did. You know, we brought this music to the world. You know, we are the ambassadors of this music. I don't care what you say, who this, what's going on. Wonder Mike, Big Bang Hank, and Master G are the first of their kind. Period.
Shifting gears a little bit.
Okay.
But not really. But kind of. So outside of Rapper's Delight,
yes,
the other song we hear from often in terms of being that song is Apache.
Hey. Let me tell you.
Tell me about Apache.
Okay. So like I said, when at the parties, we used to spin that same two records, put them together, put that break beat, and we spun that record at the parties. We have now recorded Eighth Wonder, Rapper's Delight. We're established. We're, you know, we're stars now. You know, I hate to use the word star, but we're very famous. We're very known. So we're looking for another song. So somebody says, hey, let's use, you know, Bongo Rock. Okay, they go in the studio. They come up with this beautiful composition of, you know, bum, 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 horns. And then the bass line, because we want to rap on it. And because it was Apache, you know, Mike and I kind of came up with the idea of the Lone Ranger. That's why we talk about Tonto and Kemosabe and all of that kind of that thing. We cut the record. The record comes out. It's okay. It's a B-level kind of hit. It's not a major record. Eighth Wonder was a bigger record. Rapper's Delight was a bigger record. By this time, the Furious Five, Flash and the Furious Five had come out, and they had Freedom, and they had records. And okay, boom. Now, we're moving into the 90s. There's a show, Fresh Prince of Bel-Air. And there's an episode of the Fresh Prince of Bel-Air. And Will and Carlton are at this thing, and they come out and they do this dance to this song. And they got the ties on their head and the whole nine yards. Okay, so my daughter comes to me one time, and we have a house out in L.A. She says, Dad, you don't understand. Apache's like, okay, what are you talking about? You know, we're talking about, you know, this is, we cut the record in 82, 81, right. 82. It's now 93, 90. Oh, you don't understand. So it was when they had the TiVo. You remember the TiVo? Mm-hmm. She's coming out, let me show you. So she TiVos me the episode. So I'm like, okay, cool. Now, I hadn't been performing. I stopped performing from 85 to 2005. I was not touring at all. Wow. No live performances. 2005, I started going back out on the road. We do the show. Eighth Wonder, blah, 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 rap. But we hit Apache, everybody's, wow. I'm like, oh my God, wait a minute. 5, 6, 7, 8. Now, everywhere I go, I'm like, I'm leaving, we're in Europe and, you know, these different, wow. So I'm like, yo, what the? They like, yo, you don't understand. You know, because of that episode, that song is a bigger record today. It's the same record. Now, and here's the other funny thing about it. The title of the song is Apache. That's the name of the song. That recording. Once it got to that part of it, the jump on it part, the newer generation renamed the same song. So people think it's a brand new song. It's the same recording. It's the same song. There's no difference. The only difference is it had another life. So Apache has now become Jump On It. Same song. Huh. Same song, same recording.
Huh.
Yeah. 40-something-year-old song that's bigger today, which is almost unheard of.
Right, right.
The song is bigger today. It rivals Rapper's Delight when I do it on stage.
Oh, I'm not going to lie. It's Fresh Prince of Bel-Air. That's how I...
That's it. Thank you, Will.
Like, I remember
the
scene.
Thank you, Jazzy Jeff.
Like, I literally remember the
scene.
That's
what happened. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's what happened.
Huh.
After that episode, you hear it everywhere. Basketball games and whatever the case may be. Yeah. But that's what happened.
Wow. So you're still touring today.
Yes.
Do you still listen to hip-hop music?
So I hear it.
Mm.
Yeah, I hear it.
That means you do not listen.
Not because I don't appreciate it. Let me say that. I appreciate the evolution of the music.
Mm-hmm.
Because how can I not be cool with something that I helped bring to the world?
Right.
So I appreciate it. I love the fact that it's done so much for so many people. I love the fact that it has changed lives of people. If I had a dime for every time somebody told me that, you know, we changed their life or the music, because of the music, they would have been dead or in jail. And they're now, you know, entrepreneurs or they're multimillionaires or they're artists or they're producers. So I love that idea, but you have to also understand, I'm a 60-something-year-old man. I'm not necessarily going to be listening to little young Yachty or whatever his name is. You know what I mean? Not taking anything away from it. I would love to meet him. It would be a really cool thing, but I'm not listening to that. When I started making records, 17-year-old girls were listening to my music. That's who's listening to the music now. 18, 19, 20-year-old guys are listening to the people because it's a music that speaks to the younger generation. So that's why I say I hear it, but no, I don't listen to it. I'm an older cat, so I'm going to listen to different things, you know. But I am the ambassador of this music. I enjoy the fact that it's still here. Like I said, I enjoy everything that it's doing, and I enjoy what it does. But, you know, for me, I listen to Common. I listen to Kendrick. I listen to Talib Kweli. I love them. I think they're amazing. I would love to, you know, work with any one of them. I had an opportunity. We did a podcast during the pandemic. I interviewed Talib Kweli. I interviewed some amazing people. So.
Okay.
Yeah.
So who is your favorite rapper today? Is it one of those guys? Can't say yourself.
No, I'm okay. I would never say that. No way. I don't have a favorite rapper. I think that's not cool. You know, it's like, again, my position for this music is different from everybody else's position. You know, how can I single out one person when I'm connected to every one of them? You know, I'm like the tree, and on that tree it has branches, and those branches have leaves, but it all comes from the tree. So, you know, I don't have a favorite rapper. I enjoy all rappers. I enjoy everything that's going on. But there are a few people that I do listen to. Like I said, I listen to Kendrick. I listen to Common. I really enjoy listening to, you know, the stuff that he's done. I like Method Man. I think he's really amazing. He's really, really, really talented. That whole situation, the Wu-Tang Clan, I think, wow.
Right.
Shout out to them.
So hip-hop is celebrating its 50th year anniversary. What do you think the next 50 years of hip-hop looks like?
I think it's going to continue to blossom. I think it's going to continue to evolve with the world in itself. You know, people ask me a lot of times what I think about hip-hop today. And I think that it speaks to what's happening. You know, the things that a person can say now in a song, I couldn't say. You know, the things that people do now, I couldn't do. You know, when I was a kid, I smoked cigarettes and it was like taboo. If I was in public smoking a cigarette, the label would have lost their mind. I mean, now, you know, people are talking about smoking weed. I mean, it's a different world. So you have to understand. And it also goes to different places. Again, I was a suburb kid. So again, I didn't grow up with, you know, broken glass. I didn't grow up with, you know, that kind of thing. I grew up trying to get a date. I grew up, you know, trying to figure out what I was going to do in my life. But then you take the music and you take it to L.A., to South Central, where they're dealing with police brutality and, you know, guns. And so now they're talking about what they know. You switch it and take it to Harlem. You take it to the Bronx, where that's what's going on in the Bronx. So it speaks to whoever it is that has it, take it. Now, let's go to Will Smith in Philadelphia, who was somewhat of a suburb kid. What did he talk about?
Right.
You see? Right. Let's flip the script and go to Kanye out in Chicago. What happened with that? Let's use Common. He was a guy that, you know, kind of had some kind of background. So it speaks to whoever it is that's holding on to it. And that's why you get what you get.
Does it frustrate you that there's undeniably so much more money today in hip hop than there was 50 years ago? I mean, people are walking out with contracts and bags at, you know, does that frustrate you that there's so much? It doesn't.
No.
Okay.
No. Because here's the deal. Let's use professional sports. The money that a professional basketball, let's say Clyde Frazier, you know, the money that the Knicks paid him in 1977 is not the money that they paid Patrick Ewing. It's two different situations. Cost of living is going to be different. Life is different. You know, am I comfortable? I'm very comfortable. Do I live a great life? Yeah, I live a really good life. You know, trust me, I got the trappings of success. So my situation is I'm who I am. You know, I'm not worried about what's in somebody else's pocket. I'm happy. See, I believe in the power of positive energy. So I'm never going to be bent out of shape, because if you can get 30, 40 million, great, get it. You know what I mean? Because that's going to put somebody else in a position to want to do something too. As long as you're doing something with it. That's my thing. Okay, you making that kind of money? Great. Make something out. That's why I applaud Jay-Z. I applaud Puffy. I applaud Dr. Dre. I applaud all these guys that have done these phenomenal things and have got these incredible numbers, because they're making things happen, you know. So, no, you know, and then to me, it is what it is. It's not what you get. It's what you do with what you get.
Right. Is there anything that you haven't done yet that you are hoping to do in your career?
Yes.
What is that?
I'm working on having a radio career. I got a little bit of an XM show that I'm doing now. It's called the Master G Theater.
Nice.
And I'm on HUR's XM channel, 141 and 142, the HBCU. So I have that. I always wanted to be, and see, that was the other thing, and people don't really realize this, that the other thing that I wanted to do was be a DJ.
Mm.
So that was another game plan also. So I was going to also try to get into communications, because Frankie Crocker, who is the Lord and Master of New York radio,
right,
was a friend of ours.
Ah.
So one of the planes that I had the pleasure of flying in was Frankie Crocker, because my father taught him how to fly. So I wanted to be Frankie Crocker. So I've always wanted to be, you know, at a radio station and have a job like a lot of my peers. You know, Chubb's got a thing, and they got the thing going on, the Rock the Bells, and everybody's got their thing. And again, a shout out to them. So that's something I really look forward to. And then I've dabbled in film and television. I've done some commercials. I've done some acting. And so I would like to make that happen before, you know, I decide to sit down.
Yeah, so when are you going to sit down?
I don't know. I, as long as it keeps on feeling this great, I don't know. I can't say, because I'm having the time of my life.
That's fantastic.
Yeah. Yeah. The touring is amazing. You know, the opportunities. You know, we've actually, one of the things that I'm doing now, I started a company called Adonis Entertainment Group. And we're opening the doors now to develop a young artist. And we're going to do motion pictures. We're going to do, music. And so that's something that I'm really excited about right now.
Is this going to be your first time taking that mentorship role?
Yes.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yes. People have come to me for years and they wanted me to do it. And I really wasn't in the right place, in the right space. But now I have such an amazing team. And, you know, there was a lot of stuff going on with Sugar Hill Gang that I had to really kind of work with and get right. So now that we got Sugar Hill Gang good, and, you know, I got a great group of people that, you know, help me deal with that on a day-to-day basis. Shout out to Leland Robinson, who, you know, is the remaining member of the Robinson family, he and I are business partners and brothers. And we've buried all hatchets and, you know, righted, you know, all the wrongs. And that situation, shout out to all my guys over there, Hen Dog and T Dynasty and all those cats that helped me with Sugar Hill Gang. And so it's given me that freedom, and it's given me that mind space to be able to now receive and accept new talent development and moving in that direction. So that's what Adonis Entertainment is all about.
So this question's got maybe harder for you to answer than some of the other folks I've interviewed. But one question I ask everyone is, what was that record that made them fall in love with hip hop? You didn't have that record.
Right.
So what was it, though, that made you fall in love with hip hop?
I was already in love with it before I started making records because I was doing it. It was my thing. I did parties on the weekend.
What made you want to do that then?
Do parties?
Yeah. What made you want to be a DJ? What was it?
I wanted to make money. I was always a hustler. I've been a hustler my whole life. Yeah. Like I said, you know, we talked about that. You know, I come from an era where, you know, most of the people of color were self-made, you know, and in the suburbs, in that New Jersey, Hackensack, Teaneck area, most of the people in the 60s and the 70s came from New York and they were self-made people. You know, so that was my nature. That was my thought process. So when I got into a situation where I was 15, 16 years old and my mom was going through whatever she was going through, it was like, okay, I got to figure out a way to make some extra money. So being in a music setting and being in the music scene, the DJ thing started becoming very popular. Other people were DJing. So I had access to equipment and I had the mind of an entrepreneur. So I put a stereo system together and partnered up with my buddy that had another stereo system. And we talked a beautiful girl like you into throwing a house party. And I started making business cards and passing out flyers in school. And yeah, it's 15, 16 years old. The name of my DJ group was Phase 2. That's why if you listen to Rapper's Delight, it says it's Phase 2 doing to do. Well, that was the name of the group. But I was running a business at, you know, 16 years old.
Wow.
That's how I felt. So when it came to me doing it in the studio, it was like, again, I'm thinking on a business mind. I'm thinking not only am I be able to get some dates, but I'm going to be able to get some more
some
parties.
Money to That's pay right. for those dates.
Exactly.
All right. So now I want to hear, you know, we are going to pretend like I have paid for your concert.
Oh, my goodness.
You know, that's right. I want to hear you rap. Let's hear Rapper's Delight.
Oh, God. So we'll do... Instead of M-A-S-T-E-R, the G with a double E. See, go by the unforgettable name of the man they call the Master G. See, my name is known all over the world by all the foxy ladies and the pretty girls. I'm going down in history as the baddest little rapper they could ever be.
Nice.
Yeah.
Nice. What'd your moms think when she heard that?
She thought that I was a little cocky at the time. She was like, really, guy? You know, my name is Guy, so, you know, she was like, oh, is that what you're doing? Yeah, my mother was kind of like a really grounded kind of person, so she was looking at it sideways, but I said, okay, I'm going to go with it.
It worked out in the end.
It worked out well, yes.
All right, how does hip-hop make you feel?
Oh, my God, that's a good question. So there's a lot that goes into me getting up and doing my thing. Like, there's a flight, and there's... drivers and there's and there's agents and there's so much that goes into it. It's not like when I was a kid. You know, when I was a kid, you know, my friend's mom used to bring the equipment in the back of her station wagon to somebody's house. Bless her heart, Miss Cook, if you're still here, I thank you, because again, we couldn't even drive. You know, I didn't even have a car. So this woman would 8 o'clock would take all of this equipment to your house. And the party would go till 1 o'clock. We would call Miss Cook at 1 o'clock in the morning. This woman would get out her bed and drive the station wagon over to wherever the party was.
Wow.
And we put all the stuff in the thing and then take it back to Kevin, my friend Kevin's house. This is different now. You know, like I said, you know, we have all of these people and handlers and there's a lot of moving parts to get me to that point where I walk on that stage and do my thing. But I'm telling you, if it's 20 minutes, if it's 2 hours, it's still the best part of the whole thing. You know, yeah, I want to live a good life. I got a family, so trust me, people, you know, you got to take care of your family. And, you know, you want to take care of your family at a high level. So I'm not saying that I don't appreciate the accolades and all the things that come with it. But for me, it's still rocking a party, whether it's 10 people or 100,000 people. And I'm telling you, I do festivals and I've done Formula One concerts in Singapore and I've done, you know, bar mitzvahs, you know, it's the actual essence of getting on a mic and rocking a crowd. That's hip hop to me. Like, I know it's rap and hip. To me, it's still... if I can rock the crowd and the, like I told you, like I'm emotionally connected to rocking a mic, to getting down, you know. So it's almost like a love affair. Then you sometimes you're in a relationship, you don't feel like your love is really kicking it with you. Something might be right. Hey, but, so now you're working to make it right. But then when you get it right, it's like, it's the same thing for hip hop for me.
So are you getting energy from the crowd or from the mic?
I get energy from me, and then I get energy from the crowd seeing that I'm getting the energy. Mm. See, I like to see people enjoy me. And the more that I see them enjoying me, the more that they understand that I am really doing this for real, it just makes me high. Like literally after I get off the stage, it takes me almost like an hour to calm down. Mm-hmm. And I don't drink, I don't smoke, I don't do drugs, I don't take, you know, any kind of enhancing. I don't, because I can literally go from being laid back to hit that stage and I'm on, as they say, 100, is that what they say? We're on 10 or whatever it is.
Right.
But and then I'm so amped up. Like I'm so amped up. Sometimes I get a headache because I'm going so hard. Like when I get off the stage, I gotta literally like sit down and just kind of like, because I'm so, it's so amazing for me.
Were your kids embarrassed by you? Because like when I was younger, I was embarrassed by anything my parents did. So how did your kids react to you and your fame when they were younger?
So like the only, my youngest two, so I have a son that's 28 and my daughter's 23. So, I was in business at that time.
Okay.
They got like remnants of it, but they didn't really have it like in spades. My kids didn't really start understanding my fame till now.
Mm.
Yeah. So when they were younger, it was different. Even my oldest son, he's 40, but he didn't really start. They didn't really get it, you know, because again, I didn't move like that, you know, and I'm not the typical celebrity.
Right.
I never really move like, I don't even move like that right now.
Right.
Like going to the game is a big deal for me. Mm-hmm. You know, like I'm going to be with the who's who's. I'm tripping, you know, I'm like, wow, they want me to come to the game.
Are you going
to
be hanging out with Spike Lee?
I don't know. I'm like, wow. I'm like, what up? Get it back. So it didn't happen till later.
Okay.
Because that's when people started talking about, you know,
right,
Sugar Hill Gang and this and that. And like I said, Will Smith, my daughter.
Right.
And it was really like their friends' parents.
Mm.
They kind of were like, do you understand who your dad
right.
is? I'm like, that's my friend's mom wants to meet you. And my friend's dad thinks you're like, that I don't understand. You know, like.
But when I told my mom I was interviewing you, that is what impressed her.
See?
Nothing else in my, like, that right there.
See?
Like, insane. That's what impressed her.
Yeah. Moms, they'll be like, Master G, oh, wait a minute. He was my favorite.
Seriously.
I
was supposed to call my mom to get questions from her that she wanted me to ask. I was like, I'm not doing that. I don't have time to deal with Sandra Rowe today. We're going to put that to the side. So
it's all good. Tell your mother I said hi.
I shall. Oh, my. You were trying to get me divorced from my mom. If I did a FaceTime and she was not ready and she saw
yeah,
you.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. No,
not
no, no.
Not to mention, my mom would start swooning and then my dad would be like, whoa,
yeah, I don't.
Whoa,
yeah,
whoa.
Yeah, we don't want to do that. Yeah, I've had that.
Divorced.
I've had to deal with that all my life.
Yeah.
So, no,
yeah.
no. I'm like, yo, peeps, we're good.
Yeah,
trust me.
Do you have a favorite moment in hip hop history?
Wow, that's a heavy question. Yeah, when it started being recognized on the platforms, you know, because, you know, we had the hottest record in the world and they didn't give us the time of day. Nobody. No new artists, no Grammy single, best single. We got none of that. So like now, you know, they're getting ready to do this big thing and, you know, the whole nine yards out there. We actually, my label mates out there, Grandmaster Melly Mel and Flash and Scorpio, and shout out to the Ethiopian King, the guy that performs with us. They're doing it now. So yeah, those are moments that let me know that, you know, it's getting in the right places. And then, you know, there's so many moments, Puffy, you know, whatever he's calling himself now, I don't want to disrespect him, but I mean, to be a party promoter,
right,
to, you know, Bad Boy Entertainment, what they've done, Death Row, I mean, Dre, Snoop, there's so many hip hop moments. Come on, there's no one moment that I'm proud of. I'm proud of all of the achievements that everybody's doing because it just only makes it better for the people that's coming behind it.
Right. What does hip hop mean to you?
Life, love, the pursuit of happiness, you know, yeah. Money.
Sure. Money.
Money.
A quick story that people may not know that you want to share.
Wow. That I was completely against my whole existence as Master G of the Sugar Hill Gang from 1985 to 2005. You couldn't talk to me about it. You couldn't play my music around me. I didn't want to hear it. I didn't want to know it. I didn't want to see it. I was going through a really tough time being Master G, and that even to this day, it's still very difficult to be the celebrity part of being Master G. Like, you know, I'm a very low-key person. I live in, you know, the Virginia area. I play golf and work out, and, you know, I keep a really low profile. I'm just not my way. So I think that's the thing that I think people don't really know that I think people should understand. Like, for me, it's all about the work. It's all about the work. The other stuff is all just a byproduct of when you're an artist and you're a successful artist or actor or writer, whatever it is, the byproduct is the notoriety. You know, one of the people that I think did an amazing job was Daft Punk, you know, and they had the helmets, right? So they can walk around,
right?
And the music is hugely successful. That was a brilliant idea because they know. They know what it's like. And I, to a certain degree, know what that's like. Like, I can walk down the street and a person won't say two words to me. But then I might, you know, turn the corner and somebody be like, oh, snap, G, what's up? You know, or I can walk down the street or walk around for 6 months or walk around and then walk into a venue and then everybody gets nervous and starts acting weird and that whole idea, because now it's officially, I call it being famous. It's like, now I got to be famous. Like, when I leave my house, I'll be like, okay, I got to go be famous. You know, it's a whole, so that's something that I think people don't know that I wrestle with it even to this day.
Wow. What made you then, if you were feeling like this, where you wanted nothing to do with your music being Master G from 05 to, I think
2005. From 85 to 2005.
85 to 05. What was it then that made you decide to embrace the Master G within you?
In 2005?
Yeah.
Michael Wright, Wonder Mike. So Wonder Mike and I have been friends since we were initially put in this group together. He is my best friend in the world. I tell people, Mike is my longest relationship. And so when I was in business and doing my own thing, we always had a thing that no matter what would happen, once he stepped away from the existing situation, that whatever he wanted to do, I would do. And that's what happened. In 2005, he called me up and he was like, look, man, I'm not dealing with the label anymore. There's some people that are interested in doing something, but they won't do it unless you're involved. And that's what made me initially go into it. And it still took me from 2005, it took till now to really start being comfortable with being, you know, the celebrity fame Master G. That's why, you know, I'm willing to do one of the reasons why I'm moving into doing Adonis and why I'm taking these interviews, because for a long time I didn't want to do interviews. I didn't want to. Right. I still was very, very, very shut off. Mm. I come in, I'm going to do the show,
right?
But I'm not doing all the other stuff.
Right, right, right.
You can see me on stage, but
that was it.
I'm off the stage in the car and I'm gone. Yeah.
Wow. Well, welcome back. We are so glad that
I'm glad to be here. I'm having
again.
The time of my life.
All right.
Yeah.
Listen, if you run a radio station, hire this man. I would listen to a show that he hosted. So would my mom. Next week, we are continuing our story with part 3 of The Birth of Hip Hop. We'll talk about the song whose contribution to hip hop cannot be overstated, The Message by Grandmaster Flash and the Furious Five. The MC shared with the world what life was really like in the Bronx and other communities who were disenfranchised. Decades later, it is still a powerful song. So next week, we'll talk about that, the transition to diss records, and what many consider the golden age of hip hop. Thanks so much for listening. Beyond Black History Month, A Hip Hop May Takeover is a special production of 1010 Winds, WCBS News Radio 880, and Odyssey. If you're enjoying our series, please rate and review our show and subscribe. Special thanks to producers Dempsey Pilott and Jill Webb. Andy Egan Thorpe is our audio engineer, and I'm your host and managing producer of podcasts, Fahmy Redwood.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.